Thank you very much, Monique. Before I start the presentation, I would like to introduce myself. I'm working in quantitative credit strategy within the credit research group at Société Générale. That's a research we have initiated now nearly 5 years ago. We are based in Paris, and the purpose of our research is to bridge the gap between what I could say is academic quantitative research and applied investment management and trading strategies. And we are really trying to do both things at the same time. So we work on three levels. On the first level, we write monthly long-term research notes. Historically, we've been focusing on a bit of statistical analysis, quite a lot on CDOs, cash flow and synthetic CDOs, and all types of credit derivatives. The relationship between credit and equities is one of our favorite research topics. And we've been working on some research on risk management as well. When we like some models and we see they can be popular among our readers, we update them on a weekly basis, and we use that in order to produce concrete trade recommendations and analysis of the market, and then we update our preferred models. So just one word, we are a big provider of internships, so if you've got students or if you know people who want to do internship in finance in Paris, we would be very glad to receive your details. So I understand the topic of the seminar, of this seminar, is very much about credit derivatives and the equity-credit relationship as well. Equity credit is something we have analyzed for quite a long time now. At the beginning, we used to work on equity-based signals for pure credit trading strategies. And then by the beginning of last year, we started to build a series of models for really playing credit against equities. Because by the beginning of 2004, we have seen a huge development in the number of hedge funds, especially in Europe and in London. And many of these people with a convertible background were very much interested in diversifying their strategies a little bit, whereas remaining involved in the strategies they were a little bit familiar with. So that's the purpose of my presentation today, to present you a process we have set up. It's a mixed quantitative and qualitative process. In the first part, I will explain you how we build trade ideas. I think it's a very basic process, so I won't spend too much time on it. In the second part, I will focus on our hedging strategy. All right, so once we have monitored an opportunity, or what we think is an opportunity between credit and equity, how find the right number of shares to put in front of a CDS, what kind of equity derivative product do we use in order to hedge the volatility sensitivity. We have decided to use something else than the traditional firm value model. That's a model that I think is very familiar to all the people involved in the convertibles business. And I will show you how we have implemented that model in order to hedge CDSs using stock. And then in the first part, I will detail a little bit our recommendations and, you know, what in practice we think is the behavior of these equity credit trades. So in the first part, you know, it's very nice to build a hedging strategy, but we don't really believe that equities in themselves are a right hedging tool for credit. At least we wouldn't recommend to an asset management company to hedge their CDS portfolio on a broad basis using equities. Instead of that, we use equities in order to find interesting signals for credit trading and eventually in order to play relative value on some specific opportunities between credit and equities. The model we use in order to try and find opportunity is, I think, very, very traditional. It's a Merton-like model. There is quite little to be said on the model. So the philosophy here is to take some balance sheet data, to take some data on equity implied volatility and on the equity implied volatility surface, and modulo some hidden parameters, find a theoretical spread. Once we get a theoretical spread, we can split the investment universe between the investment grade market and the crossover market, and on each part of the investment universe, we can look at rich names and cheap names. We don't really believe in buying cheap names simply because market spread is significantly above model spread, simply because on these names the model can be absolutely wrong. So what we are doing is looking at the cheap names that have become cheaper over the last days, over the last weeks, and look at the rich names that have become richer. And basically, what we are doing is playing on changes in relative value using the long-term model as a way to sort out names that are not rich on an absolute sense. So here, that's an example of the process we use in order to find opportunities. So we filter the investment universe between cheap and rich names and look at changes. And as we'll see in the last part of the presentation, that very simple process happens to be quite useful in finding relative value opportunities. I think the process here has been useful because we've got access to high quality data in terms of equity implied volatility. SocGen is a strong player in the equity derivatives area, and certainly that's one of the big inputs in that kind of analysis. So once we got a trade, how are we going to play the trade? The standard and most simple response would be to use the same model that has been used to find the trade in order to hedge the trade. And in practice, that certainly is something we would like to get, because if we want to get a full control on the P&L, if you really want to make the money between the theoretical spread and market spread, we should, in theory, I think, use the model, the firm value model, to hedge the strategy. The point is that the firm value model, even if it's still a little bit more sophisticated than the pure Merton theory of the credit grade model, a traditional firm value model is hardly a good pricer of the credit market. On these two graphs, we can clearly see that there is a strong bias in the model itself, and it's not that easy to correct that bias because there are many things that are not factored in the model. Moreover, even with a better model, and for instance, we've been working recently on a model that fits better to the credit market. Even with such a model, if you use the model in order to simulate the sensitivity of the CDS to market input, you would realize that firm value models tend to have an extremely low delta and a huge vega. In other words, most of the information we use comes from the equity derivatives market. So in order to get a trade that might be nice, in order to hedge the trade, it is a little bit more difficult, because in practice, the statistical correlation between CDS and stock is a little bit higher than the model-based correlation between CDS and stock. So what we would like to do for hedging purposes is to use a model that is dependent not only on equity implied volatility, but gives a greater importance to the stock price itself. So that's the purpose of a model we have called the EC hedge model for equity credit. The very idea is the model is to take some distance from firm value models and say, well, a firm value model is extremely complicated, because it views credit as a digital out-of-the-money option, so that's fair. Equity is supposed to be a done-and-out call option, which is already a little bit more sophisticated. And an equity option is a compound call done-and-out option. So in theory, if you want to be really clear on your process, you have to work on a two-level, on two different levels, in order to take information from equity prices and equity implied volatility. In top of that, the model relies on information from balance sheet, on debt numbers, which are not necessarily a primary input in order to find the right hedge ratio for a CDS. So if you take some distance from things and look at the data, here for example in the case of Alcatel, throughout 2002, 2004, you can see that there is a rough linear relationship between the log of CDSs, or the log of CDS implied intensity, and the log of the stock price of a company. So rough as it may be, this relationship suggests to postulate a direct link between short-term default risk and the stock price of a company. So that's the first equation here in this model. We make the assumption, and that's a pure assumption. It's the role of further backtesting to show whether that assumption proves to be efficient or not. So we make the assumption that short-term default risk is inversely proportional to the stock price of a company. And then we bring a few minor adjustments to that relationship in order to take into account possibly a component, a part of the CDS spread that is not directly linked to the stock price, and in order to include a drift component in the stock price itself. So, in a nutshell, there are three major parameters in that model. First, the alpha. Right, the alpha here is what we call a scale parameter or a convexity parameter. Tells you at which power we should adjust the stock price in order to link it to the short-term default risk. A high alpha means that there should be a huge convexity between stock price and default risk. Alpha set to zero means, in theory, that there is absolutely no relationship between stock price and default risk. The mu is what we call the debt growth rate, because basically we could interpret this factor on the bottom side of the equation as the debt per share ratio of the company, as the inverse of the debt per share ratio. So the mu factor is akin to the growth rate of the debt of the company, and that's how we interpret it in practice. In this application here, we set this debt growth rate at the exact level of the swap rate implied riskless rate. In other words, we make the assumption that the company operates at a constant leverage, which, at a first approximation, I think makes sense. And then the B parameter, in practice, is exactly what will give us the level of the hedge ratio to put in front of the CDS. There is one more hidden parameter in the model, that's the loss rate. So the amount of money that is supposed to be lost in case of a credit event. And I will elaborate further on this loss rate a little, some slides further. Once we postulate that kind of short-term relationship, the one thing we need to do is to simulate the stock price using its equity implied volatility as a proxy in order to make the bridge between short-term default risk and long-term default risk. So in other words, between short-term default intensity and 5-year CDS. So numerically, we use a partial differential equation there, so in order to move from short-term default risk and long-term default risk. The factor here that has quite an important influence is the level of equity implied volatility, because it tells how much the short-term influence of the stock price is smoothed when it comes to analyzing 5-year CDS. The way we use the model is very, fairly simple. At a given date, we download data from the equity derivatives market, we download data from the stock market, and we download data from the CDS curve. We fit the model and find the implied B parameter that fits both to CDS and equity implied volatility data. And we get the implied equity volatility as well. In other words, we adjust the Black-Scholes implied volatility against the risk of a default, and we find the B parameter, in other words, the direct relationship between CDS and stock price. And that is this parameter that will make it possible to estimate a possible hedge ratio for a CDS. So it is a very simple process. Obviously, there are brilliant statisticians here in this, and I think the presentation by Johan is a little bit more sophisticated in terms of getting statistical insight on financial markets. The trouble with the credit market, in my own experience, is that it is highly non-stationary and on a very, very non-linear way. So I will give you a case study from my own experience. So in 2002, as we started to work with hedge funds, we had designed a statistical system to find the number of shares to put in front of a CDS. And so we were running so that system based on a little bit of co-integration and non-parametric statistics. And then one day, a client called me to get a hedge ratio for Suez. And on that very day, as you may know, the CDS spread of Suez had jumped by around 80 basis points, and the stock price of Suez had decreased, had plummeted very sharply, and Suez were trading at a level never seen before. So how was I supposed to get a statistical delta on a company that was trading at a level never experienced before? So I think it either requires a much more sophisticated degree in terms of statistical analysis. An alternative, and that's something we tend to prefer here in my team at SocGen, is to try and model the market, because the market is very young, and the quality of data is extremely low, and the market is unstable itself. And so that's what we are doing here. So that's a case study here in April 2004. We downloaded the last data on Alcatel in terms of the stock price, the 5-year CDS, and the 1-year equity implied volatility. We fitted the model, and then we used the model to simulate a theoretical change in the CDS spread against the stock price, and we compared that to statistical to empirical data. So the model relationship appears to be quite in line with market experience. There is a gap because indeed the draw line here was estimated based on a constant equity implied volatility. And as we know, the equity implied volatility of Alcatel has been quite volatile throughout the crisis in 2002. So, as in any pricing model, there are weak points, and the weak points of this approach is certainly the choice of the scale parameter, the famous alpha parameter. It's very difficult to estimate that parameter, and as these graphs show, this parameter has a huge direct impact on the delta, and especially on second-order risk, on the gamma, and on the slope of the CDS curve. So, obviously, we are designing a process where everything is based on some kind of statistical experience. So this statistical relationship between short-term default risk and stock price. And we have very, very, very little insight on that relationship. Because what we are supposed to observe is a kind of convexity. So a first solution would be to try and estimate that alpha parameter, that scale parameter, on a line-by-line basis in order to fit the model to specific experience on a given company. The point is that if you keep in mind my example on Suez, how was a statistical estimate to be efficient before the crisis in 2002 if the company had never gone throughout the crisis? So we've done a very, very simple estimate here. So we regressed on the log of spread implied intensities against the log of stock prices on a basket of 110 companies. We look at that level as a function of the average spread on the basket, on the company. So if you look on the left, this ratio happens to be quite low, around 1. Quite negligible in practice, on all the companies that have traded on average below 50 basis points. That's quite the same story on the right. If you look at companies that traded, that used to trade consistently around 300, 400 basis points, the convexity parameters appears to be in practice quite low, close to 1. So, should 1 be the kind of parameter we should select for that application? The trouble is that when you look at a company, like a crossover company, that has really gone through a crisis, actually it appears that the convexity is really observed when the company moves from 100 to 200 basis points. Okay, that's what I've shown, tried to show on the first graph on Rolls-Royce. On Rolls-Royce, we cut the historical data on days during the crisis, or days before the crisis. All right, so before the crisis, it was hardly possible to estimate the convexity because there was hardly any convexity to be seen. And during the crisis, there was hardly any convexity to be seen either. The trouble is that if you put everything together, you get a view on convexity, and this convexity can be experienced during a crisis. And so I think the question is, when you design when you use that kind of model, whether you want the strategy to really fit to what has happened on that specific company over the previous weeks. And I know some people prefer to estimate the alpha, the scale parameter, on a case-by-case basis, or whether you want to keep in mind that this company, that has always been a stable company, could be another Enron, could be another Suez, or could be another Rolls-Royce. So our choice has been to use quite a conservative alpha that is supposed to be common to all companies, because we know the market, the credit market, is extremely young, and we know that we are playing on quite extreme events. So there are other parameters in the model. The debt growth rate is quite an interesting parameter. As I said, we set it to the level of the swap rate in order to make the assumption that the company operates at constant leverage. This debt growth rate has a direct impact on the theoretical slope of the CDS curve. So that's quite interesting because it provides another way to look at a CDS curve. For a given CDS curve, one could find the implied debt growth rate that fits to the CDS curve and use that as a relative value indicator. So that's something we do in another model in order to try and find opportunities in the CDS curve. And I think it's quite interesting to link the problem of finding the right debt growth rate to a problem that was mentioned yesterday in the framework of firm value models. So in other words, when you get a CDS curve, can you find the barrier, the implied barrier that fits to the series of default probabilities implied by the CDS curve? I think it's very much similar. Well, there is one parameter nobody never talks about. Well, that's the loss rate. The loss rate has quite a strong importance on outputs from credit pricing models. Happily enough, in that case, around 60%, the loss rate occurs to have a very limited impact on both the edge ratio and the CDS curve. In other words, given that market practice is to use a 60% loss rate assumption on the corporate market, around that level, the model happens to be relatively insensitive to that key parameter. And finally, the one factor that has a lot of that is very important here, that's the equity implied volatility. I think the model is interesting because it manages to take information from the equity implied volatility market relatively simply. Equity implied volatility is very useful because it has a direct impact on the hedge ratio. The higher the equity implied volatility of the stock, obviously, the lower the number of shares that we have to put in front of the CDS in order to hedge the trade. Equity implied volatility has a direct impact on second-order risk as well, or second-order risk estimates. And it has a direct impact on the CDS curve. When equity implied volatility is higher, the CDS curve, in theory, should steepen. So how does it work in practice? Here we backtested a possible strategy. So using a scale parameter set at 2, so that's the convexity parameter, the weak point in the model, we made this assumption that the convexity parameter is 2. So we simulated the dynamic hedging strategy first in the case of Alcatel. Obviously, Alcatel is an easy case study because there has been during that period, and not necessarily over the last month, there used to be a strong statistical correlation between CDS and stock. So one would expect the stock price to be a right hedge for the CDS of Alcatel, and I think that's the answer. So the line is gray here is the performance of a short CDS on Alcatel. The line is red is the performance of a short CDS hedged by a stock equity exposure. And what we've tried to do as well is to benchmark the EC hedge model here against a traditional use of the firm value model, of a Merton-like model. What I call a traditional use here is a very, very basic application of the firm value model. You download a 5-year CDS spread, get all you need in terms of balance sheet numbers and market cap data, but you don't take a profit from equity implied volatility. What you're doing in that application is fitting the volatility of the asset value of the company to the 5-year CDS spread. In other words, get the spread implied equity volatility in order to fit a firm value model to the credit market, and then use that implied data to get a delta estimate and hedge the model. So here, I think the EC hedge model is a little bit superior to the firm value approach, but there is hardly any striking difference. Looking at a few individual case studies, the results are not always as optimal as they seem to be in the case of Alcatel. In some cases, like on DT and Rolls-Royce, results appear to be relatively decent. On cases like Ahold, where there was a real crisis, a real unexpected crisis, by no surprise, the equity did not provide a really efficient hedge during the crisis because there was a jump in credit spreads. And furthermore, in the case of Ahold, not only did the CDS spread recover, but the stock price performed relatively well. So obviously the short CDS, short stock strategy didn't bring a strong performance. Overall, we backtested the strategy on a basket of 110 companies, and our result is what you could get, you can get here on the line in red. So the hedging strategy appears to stabilize, I would say, to stabilize the P&L of a short CDS portfolio, especially compared to a naive use of a firm value model. I think it provides infinitely superior results because I think during that period, over 2002, the naive application of a firm value model didn't take profit from equity implied volatility. And therefore, the firm value model would tell you to put a lot of stock in front of a CDS, therefore adding the volatility of the stock market to that of the equity of the CDS market instead of stabilizing the P&L of the strategy. By contrast, the intensity model we present here takes a look at the level of equity implied volatility, and if a company has a high equity implied volatility, our model here reduces accordingly the number of shares to put in front of a CDS. The trouble here is that starting 2003, the red line diverges from the x-axis, and what we would like to get is a red line that stays as close to the x-axis as possible. So the question is why? Is the model absolutely fake? Is that due to technical factors, or is something missing in the hedge strategy? Well, that's something we'll discuss later in the presentation. But I would like to stress here that anyway, these are relatively good results, especially during the 2002 crisis. The equity-based strategy happens to stabilize significantly the performance of a CDS portfolio. So it lays the ground for playing CDS against stock, for trying and play credit relative value on selected opportunities. So in our own experience, and we will see that a little bit later, the stock price is not always the right hedge to a CDS, so we try to use equity derivatives as well, and there are two reasons for this. The first reason is that just in terms of exercise payoff, being short CDS and short stock is a little bit dangerous. Right, that kind of strategy is too strongly gamma negative. So if whatever significant happens in the company, that kind of trade can lose quite a lot of money. And therefore, buying protection, additional protection through an equity derivative product provides a way to stabilize the strategy. Moreover, and that's something we will see later, equity implied volatility happens to be highly correlated with spreads. So it's an additional factor that can be used in order to stabilize the mark-to-market of a CDS equity trade. So one simple solution in order to delta vega hedge a CDS is to buy stock. Well, if you want to hedge a long CDS position, you can buy stock in order to hedge the delta of a CDS, so a theoretical equity component of a CDS, and use, for example, an equity straddle or whatever equity derivative that is mainly dependent on its vega in order to hedge the vega exposure of a CDS. And that provides the kind of P&L profile you can see here. Another strategy in practice is to use puts in front of a CDS, and people tend to use simply puts and try and delta vega hedge at the same time, and that is possible if you bring some kind of maturity adjustment to the vega estimate of the CDS and the vega estimate of the option. Right. What I forget to say here is that a CDS is traditionally a five-year contract, and the kind of liquid option we can find in order to hedge the CDS in a relative value perspective is usually a one-year option. So there is obviously a huge maturity mismatch there, and people tend to cope with that mismatch by adjusting the vega of the CDS by the square root of 5. And adjusting the vega by the square root of 5 happens in practice to make it possible to delta and vega hedge at the same time a CDS using a put option. Okay, so that's for the model. I think we have exhibited a framework that is extremely simple compared to the complex firm value approach. That framework is direct because it uses as an input the stock price and the company. It focuses on the real purpose of hedging. Okay, it takes as an input the stock price and uses that as a driving factor. And our backtesting analysis shows that this model provides decent results in terms of stabilizing the P&L profile of a CDS portfolio. So we combine the firm value model explained in the presented in the first part of the presentation with that hedging model in order to try and play on relative value. So we have started providing recommendations, so roughly 1 year ago, by the beginning of April 2004. What we do systematically, especially when we recommend a short CDS position, is to cross-check this with credit analysis, alright, because one never knows, a company may jump from 100 to 500 basis points, and in that case, it's quite important to, well, try and avoid as much as possible that type of crisis, which unfortunately occur quite frequently on the credit market. During the first part of our experience, we played exclusively CDS against stock. And as I said, that's a little bit dangerous because a short CDS, short stock, is not hedged at all against whatever crisis towards a wider spread. Well, the trouble is we had in practice was quite the opposite. We tended to overweight long CDS, long stock trades because of their positive convexity. And as many people with a convertible arbitrage background tend to focus on convexity and try and carry out second-order strategies, well, we try to play second-order risk. The trouble is that throughout the summer of 2004, not only did spreads tighten, but equity prices decreased at the same time, and therefore the strategy didn't manage to be hedged in any sense. And when you look at the data, during that very period, equity implied volatility decreased quite significantly as well in a way that was strongly correlated with the tightening in spreads. So a portfolio of equity options would certainly, and that's what we have checked, it would have stabilized the P&L of the strategy. So starting September, well, that's the middle, the peak there, decided to include, when possible, when liquidity makes it possible, we decided to include equity derivative products in our recommendations, and the strategy has managed to work much more steadily, even during the recent crisis. The trouble, well, here's a concrete case study on a recommendation we made on Capgemini. It's quite interesting because I think it shows how the stock and the equity volatility managed to hedge part of the CDS risk and how the strategy manages to take profit from a real change in the relative value between credit and equity. Capgemini is a CDS that was not liquid, and then suddenly, following fears of a downgrade by rating agencies, the market quite sharply adjusted the quotations of the CDS of Capgemini, and the relative value trade, whose performance is drawn in black on the right side, so managed to take profit from that change in valuation, whereas just playing the CDS was a little bit tedious, if you look at the red line. In the current environment, which is very technical, it happens to be quite important to trade and stabilize an equity portfolio between short CDS and long CDS exposure. Well, in practice, unfortunately, I think that's the trouble of... through which have gone many people who have traded equity against credit recently. I think in practice there is a very, very low understanding of what is a beta, of what is a beta neutral portfolio, and I think many traders were expected to be long protection and occurred to lose a lot of money during the March-April crisis because they had not measured their risk well. So what we are trying to do in order to cope that problem is to propose systematically a short CDS in front of a long CDS and use statistical analysis when suitable in order to design the amount of the former trade in order to put in front of the later. So here that's an example on a Lufthansa against British Airways trade where we trade to basically buy protection on Lufthansa, short protection on British Airways, and do the opposite trade on the equity side. This trade was played, you may not realize it, but that trade was played in the middle of a huge crisis on the credit market over the last 2 months. And the black line here shows that the performance of the trade managed to be totally decorrelated from overall credit spreads. So I think that's an example of good risk management. But in practice, for the people who try and play equity against credit, that's certainly one of the main challenges in the following month. So I think this presentation has shown you an example of the process to play credit against equity. We certainly think that firm value models are great models in order to find opportunities. They are a very, very poor description of the dynamic behavior of the credit market against the equity market. So the solution we have proposed is to use a more modest model. So basically a model that compares directly the stock price against the CDS spread and use that model in order to design the number of shares and the number of equity derivatives to put in front of the CDS. And both our backtesting research and our real life experience, if I can say so, show that that kind of model provides a decent answer to the question of stabilizing a relative value trade. So if you've got a few questions, I would be very glad to answer them now.